Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I'm so excited to introduce my friend, Bruce Evico. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Hi, Monique. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I'm so excited to share with our listeners everything that you know about this amazing architecture in California. Now, Bruce and I go back about 10 years, and he and I have always kind of geeked out about these architects and their work and where the homes are and how their work is different. And I'm so excited to talk with you today about a dynamic duo that you taught me about, Buff and Hensman. And so let's just get right into it. So how did you become familiar with Buff and Hensman, and you eventually worked for them? How did that come about?
When I was in high school here on the peninsula in Millbrae, where I grew up, I started to think that I wanted to study architecture. And this was in probably the early to mid 70s, and I didn't know too much about it, so I went to the local library in Millbrae and started borrowing some books. And two books in particular. One is a book called Modern California Houses. This is a 1962 publication, and it's by Esther McCoy. And basically, what it is a collection of all of the case study houses that had been designed up to that point, which is most of them. And in going through the book, I was especially drawn to case study house number 20, which is designed by Buff and Hensman. Just the way the plan unfolded and some of the details and the connection with nature and things like that. And then another book is Beautiful Homes and Gardens in California. This is by Herbert Weisskampf. It's a 1964 publication. It's actually a German book, but there is an English edition, which was what I was looking at. And they gave a pretty big spread on Buff and Hensman, about four or five houses. And I was, again, really drawn to their work, just the neatness of the plan and the connection with nature and so forth.
And tell us a little bit about Conrad Buff and Don Hensman's background and how they got connected.
Well, let me step back, because that didn't really affect me yet in terms of like working for them. Kind of jump ahead to 1979, when in the fall, this would be my last year of architecture school, and I'm down at Cal Poly in Pomona, which is outside of Los Angeles. And every October in Southern California, there's a house tour every fall, and it's put on by the WAL, which is the Women's Architectural League. I don't know if that still exists, but in those days it was composed of women architects, which there weren't that many, and I think primarily wives of architects. And what they did was they'd pick a certain location in Southern California. One year it might be Santa Monica, one year it might be Hollywood, and they put together a tour of five recently designed and built you know, basically modern or contemporary houses. Wow. It's a lot of coordination. So this particular year, 79, they decided to do Pasadena, and the work would, or the tour would be exclusively on the work of Buff and Hensman, because they had recently completed quite a few houses in that area. Mm. And so I decided, of course, to go on it. And it was a real eye-opener because it was totally different than the work in the books, which was primarily post and beam. This was a more of a sculptural kind of new way of doing things, but still very modern. And I was really impressed with the consistency of the designs and the consistency of the construction and the kind of the warm materials and so forth. So
yeah, it sounds heavenly, actually, yeah, to be immersed in that world.
So then after I graduated, about a year later, I went and knocked on their door, and to make a long story short, they hired me.
I love it. And I saw the photos of you all together. It looked like you had so much fun together, and there was that spirit of architecture alive and well. And God, that must have been
amazing. It's a small office. There was just five architects, including myself, and then the office manager.
Wow.
So it's a, you know, close-knit group.
Yeah. What was it like with that group? How did everyone work together?
Very well. Producing a Buff and Hensman house was a well-honed process. It wasn't like a lot of arty struggling or anything. It was really quite efficient. I mean, people coming and going, it was more like a dental practice or something compared to these more creative kind of, you know, artsy practices that sometimes you encounter.
Right. So tell us a little bit about Conrad Buff and Don Hensman's backgrounds and how they connected.
Okay. Conrad Buff was born in 1924 in Glendale, California. And his parents were both artists. His father in particular was quite a prolific painter of landscapes, but in a modern vocabulary. And his mother was... she was a curator at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
Oh.
And Conrad's father is also Conrad. So sometimes when we converse, the painter is CB2.
Okay.
And the architect is CB3.
So. Okay. But not to be confused with the brand CB2.
Right. And...
Yeah.
And so CB2 was born in Switzerland. So
wow.
CB1 is,
okay,
is the grandfather, and he's lived in Switzerland. And CB2 came to America as an immigrant and did various jobs and got his, you know, painting underway, and then met Mrs. Buff, Mary Buff, and they had children, including Conrad.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was a kind of a creative household, and they were part of a circle of other creative immigrants in the 1920s in Los Angeles, including Richard Neutra and Rudolf Schindler. Who they socialized with, although not together, because those two had kind of a falling out, as most architectural histories will tell you. So
there's a competing over clients and the usual drama. Yes.
So probably that had some influence on CB3 interest in architecture. And Don Hensman... I'm sorry, Conrad was born in 1926, and Don Hensman was born in 1924, I think. But they're basically the same age. He was born in Nebraska. But the family moved to California when he was very young. So he really knew no other place but Los Angeles. He grew up in Hollywood. And his father was involved in the magazine business. Exactly what he did, I don't know. But this had some good effect on the firm in terms of knowing how to, you know, connect with magazines and things like that to get their work published. And then they both served in the military during World War II. They're basically just out of high school and they signed up. And then when they were discharged and back into civilian life, they entered the architecture department at USC in 1948 and then graduated in 1952.
And so they, you know, knew each other through that as well.
Exactly. That's how they met in the Department of Architecture. And they even, I think during the summer, they did, you know, a little moonlighting type jobs and that sort of established the relationship.
Wow. And a trust there, obviously, from what they'd been through. So some of the designs are credited also to Straub. And, you know, you see that name under a lot of these designs. So who was Calvin Straub?
Calvin Straub was a professor at USC. He's a little bit older, about 5 years older. And in that generation, it kind of meant a lot as to where you were when the when World War II finally ended. He already had his degree, and as soon as he was discharged, then he started practicing and then became a faculty member at USC. And he's a brilliant designer. He's basically kind of the father of California post and beam architecture. He brought that to the forefront and influenced students, including Buff and Hensman, who, you know, took a liking to that approach to design.
Wow.
And then after they graduated and then they got their license around 1956.
Okay.
And a few years later, they actually formed a partnership with Calvin Straub. They were sometimes competing for the same clients, so it made business sense too.
Well, that's a very bold statement that you just said about Calvin, that he was the force behind the post and beam construction. I mean, that's, you know, what a lot of us look at as, you know, mid-century modernism. Post and beam was, you know, the just so important with that. And a lot of their early work is post and beam, you know, with a lot of glass and, you know, a more modernist look. But their later work was a little bit more structured or sheltering. So I wonder how that changed, or do you know how that transition happened?
Yes. Well, let's just Straub. So they joined forces around 1957 and they worked together for about 5 years. So it was Buff, Straub and Hensman, and it was a very productive period. And in 1961, Calvin Straub accepted a job to head up the architecture department at Arizona State University.
Wow.
So he, at that point, left the firm, and it, and then it reverted back to just Buff and Hensman, and they kind of continued on their way, doing lots of post and beam houses.
Wow.
And so back to your question about the transition.
Yes.
There is a couple of things that brought that about. One was, in 1971, there was the Sylmar Valley, Simi Valley Sylmar earthquake. And that was the first earthquake in modern times. And so building inspectors and engineers and architects took a look at the damage. And so the codes were rewritten, making like shear walls and things of that nature part of the requirements for building houses. And it, it had some effect on where they were going. But the main thing was the energy crisis of 1973-74. The state enacted some very strict requirements about energy consumption and how much glass you could have. And the restriction was a maximum of 16% of the floor area. This code went into effect in 75. It was very quick, very swift, unusual for the state legislature. So if it was single pane glass, you could only have 16% of the floor area. And if it was double pane glass, you could have 20% of the floor area, which is nothing compared to what they were doing. It was probably, you know, easily 50% of the floor area. So this forced a change for everybody, not just, you know, Buff and Hensman. And most people kind of, I think, whittled down what they were doing, and it wasn't really very convincing. But Buff and Hensman decided to basically start fresh and come up with a new way of designing. So they came up with, you know, what you kind of could call their second aesthetic, which is more sculptural, more sheltering. It's less glass, but it looks right because the way they designed the houses with soffits that then became overhangs to keep out the sun, and lifting the sill heights and framing it in with like heavy pilasters. And so it just kind of came about that way.
I love that. I love that they continued to try to create that. Yeah.
And they, and it, the first house they did in that new aesthetic was actually a house for Don Hensman himself, which made it easy because his requirements were very simple: one bedroom, one bathroom, and a swimming pool. And
it's very simple. It's very straightforward.
And they wouldn't have to convince a client of this whole new aesthetic and have it, you know, get tricky. So the house was photographed and was published in the Los Angeles Times Sunday Home magazine. And Don told me they got more calls from that house than anything they ever did, because it just struck a chord with people on so many levels. People who were thinking of building houses, you know, this energy crisis thing was on the news every night. So people were very aware of, you know, of what was happening. And so it seemed like a way forward, and the aesthetic itself seemed to be fresh and kind of the 70s, and it's very earthy and and so from there they went forward with lots of redwood and tile, quarry tiles, and
Well, looking through the library after you and I discussed this topic for the podcast, you'd sent me so many different references of gorgeous homes, and I couldn't pick out, you know, just one or two. So I thought, you know, we can just discuss everything was done in Southern California. But there was one house that I loved in Tahoe, actually. And I wanted to ask you about that house because it's, you know, there weren't as many photos of that house as there were of the LA homes and Southern California homes, you know, Pasadena. So I just wanted your opinion on that house and that design.
That's an interesting house, and it is, it's a little bit different than the post and beam houses, and it's a little bit different than the work from 1975 forward. I think that was done in 1973. So the energy code hadn't taken effect yet. And of course, it's in Lake Tahoe, so it's a different kind of program. It was actually built as a demonstration house for the developer of that land to show, you know, what somebody who bought a lot up there might, you know, might be able to do. It's a very clever floor plan. It's not really big, very open. Could sleep a lot of people. So if you know, if you're having a family and friends, there's and it's a kind of symmetrical in floor plan, which they sometimes did. And it's kind of in the style of the times. The shed roof was kind of a popular motif in the 70s. And yeah, it's a very, very nice design.
Yeah, I love, that's one of the ones that was in that book. The book is called Buff and Hensman, and it's edited by James Steele, for the listeners that would love to look at these visuals that we're talking about. Of course, there are so many books, and Buff and Hensman's homes are in so many different architecture books that we've referenced. We'll have our producer put the links in the column under the thumbnail online. But you also were talking about the two case study homes as well that they did. And can you share with us a little bit about those homes? And I think there's probably a story behind those homes as well.
Yes, they did two case study houses. One is case study number 20. That was 1958. And anybody who knows the case study houses, there's also another 20. I think it's a Richard Neutcher. There, many of the houses have the same number. So, but this is the Buff and Hensman number 20. And then they also did case study house number 28. That was in 1965. And that was the last case study that was built. Going back to number 20, that's actually a Buff, Straub, and Hensman. Straub was part of the firm when that was built. And it's in Altadena, California, which is near Pasadena. And they had an exceptional client. Is a man named Saul Bass, who's a very creative graphic designer. Even if you don't know his name, you would recognize some of his logos. Like one of the most famous is the spinning globe for AT&T, or Lowry's, the Spice People. I mean, there's dozens of them out there that he contributed to. And he also is involved in film, and very, very imaginative, inventive designer for film. He did, you know, the posters for lots of films from the 50s and 60s. And he also did graphics within the film. And he was really kind of a trailblazer. He's one of the first people that brought the credits of a film to the beginning of the film, where in the past it was always at the end of the film. It's like white letters on a black background, and you're going through
the... And everyone's left before you can read.
So he said, let's put them, at least the important stuff, up front.
Yes.
And a good example is Vertigo, which is,
great.
Filmed here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and where the introduction is the eye and all that, you know, and the credits sort of emerge out of the eye and the graphics and things like that. So they're working
creative.
With a very creative person. The house itself is, you know, the kind of house that a lot of people would like. It's pretty good size, but nothing, you know, nothing grand. And it had a very nice lot, basically level with a lot of existing trees. It was subdivided off of a larger, older estate. And it's one of the houses that I had mentioned in those books that I had seen. And it just, the way the space unfolds, you kind of walk through what's basically a carport entrance area, and then you open a sliding door and you're in a courtyard garden, and then you get to the front door proper, and then there's a little entryway, and And then it sort of suddenly opens into the big space, the living room, with the vaulted ceiling, and then out to the backyard. There's a swimming pool. The landscaping was done by Garrett Ekbo.
Okay.
And yeah, it's just, you know, it's very nice. It's post and beam, and lots of windows and indoor-outdoor connection. It's really very good.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, yeah, we'll have the links for all of you listening.
I'll tell you a funny story about the case study houses and modern architecture. After I moved back up to San Francisco, I got a job in a big office, or at least in architecture, what we call a big office. There was about at least 120 people. And one of the partners liked to occasionally invite people in to speak about different things. And so the office, you know, not everybody, but many people would gather around and someone would talk about something current in architecture. This is like 1984, I think. And I don't remember who it was, but she came to speak and talk about what was going on in Los Angeles architecture and in the design world in general. I think it was Barbara Goldstein was her name.
Okay.
But and she started talking, and there's like maybe, I don't know, 50 or 60 people are gathered around listening to her, probably half of the office. And she asks, is anybody here familiar with the case study house program? And not a single person, you know, raised their arm, and I kind of sleepishly raised mine. And she says, how do you know about it? I say, well, for one, I worked for Buff and Hensman, but I was aware of it before.
Well, yeah.
Now, here you have 60 architects, mostly young people, you know, my generation.
Yes.
This shows you how off the radar these houses, the whole program, had become by that time.
Unbelievable.
Not a single person. Now, if you ask any young architect today, you know, they know all about it.
Wow. That is so strange to me.
Yeah, and I
that no one.
And I think what she was talking about different things going on in Los Angeles, but I think that question was brought up because the sort of the seed for Blueprints for Modern Living, the exhibit that came along in 1989 at the Los Angeles, what was called the Temporary Contemporary, because they were building a new museum, and they set up a temporary museum in an old police garage. And so this was starting to be discussed. You know, these things take a long time. This is like 5 years before the exhibit opened. And she was mentioning that this is one of the things that, you know, historians and people like Esther McCoy and are involved in.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
And this was, like I say, 1989, and they did a big exhibit on the case study houses at the Los Angeles Contemporary Museum. They had drawings and photographs and models of all of the case study houses.
Wow.
And then they constructed two full-size models of two of the houses. One is the unbuilt design by Ralph Rapson. It's sometimes called the Greenbelt House because it had a kind of open garden between two wings. It was a very imaginative house, but didn't get built. And then the second one that they built was case study number 22. That's the famous Pierre Koenig design, you know, perched on the edge of of the cliff. Wow. So they did an astonishing job. I mean, the appliances, even the magazines on the coffee table were right from the period.
Wow.
It was, you know.
Amazing.
So, but here, you know, back at the office and unaware.
Unaware. Yeah. Unbelievable. So this, we talked about Case Study House 20, but how was Case Study House 28?
Case Study House 28 was up in Thousand Oaks, which is kind of on the outer reaches of the Los Angeles region. And it's the only one that didn't really have a live-in client, per se. The client was actually the Jans Development Company, and they had bought a lot of acreage in that area that they wanted to subdivide into lots, which they could sell. And they needed sort of like a demonstration house to kind of anchor the development and to get people to, you know, drive up there and look around maybe. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have a direct client. It was more of a, you know, a generic program. And then there was sort of a second client was the Pacific Clay Products. This is a company that makes bricks and tiles and things like that. And they wanted to showcase how in modern architecture you could use these sort of traditional materials. Mm-hmm. So somehow they landed the commission to design the house. It was a pretty big house, especially by the case study program standards. Wow. And had a swimming pool that was in a sort of central courtyard and a drive-through carport. It was a very chic house, I guess you could say, for the times, 1965. Mm-hmm. And
wow.
Yeah, it came out very nice. Yeah.
Amazing. How was the social dynamic of Buff and Hensman?
Well, that's a good question. It all kind of wove together. The clients were friends. They, you know, they socialized with them, you know, often going out to lunches, and some of them even they vacationed with and traveled around. I even had some experience with it myself. One day, this was in January, I think 1981, at my desk working, and the secretary tells me Don Hensman is on the phone. He needs to talk to you right away. And I pick up the phone, and Don says, "Bruce, are you at your desk?" And I say, "Yes." And he says, "Turn around and face my desk." And I say, "Okay, I'm looking at your desk." And he says, "Do you see a roll of blueprints for Reed Bingham's house?" And I say, "Yes." And he says, "I forgot to bring those with me last night when I left the office, and I'm having a lunch meeting with Reed Bingham and a person who was going to help get the permit at 1:30, and I need you to bring those plans to me." I said, "Okay, no problem." And he says, "We're going to meet at such and such a restaurant in Beverly Hills. And I don't know my way around." And he gives the best directions. He makes little maps and things sometimes. But of course, this is over the phone. And so yeah. Just go down Coldwater Canyon Boulevard. And when you get, you see the palm trees, you're there. And and I say, "Okay, I'm on my way." I pick the plans up and get in the car. It's like a beautiful, you know, January can be really the best time of year in Southern California. It's real clear and sunny. So I drive down and I find the restaurant and open the door and go in, and it's pitch black inside. You know, I'm coming from the bright outside, and this is like a kind of the old school restaurant. You know, it's not airy and and all I could see was the sort of like white triangle of the maitre d's, you know, shirt up, you know, at his at his neck there, and then he's wearing like a jacket, black jacket. And I say, I'm here to drop these off for Don Hensman. And he said, oh, he's expecting you. Come this way.
So, so you're okay. Joining.
So.
And then you're joining the meal.
So we go into the dining room, and my eyes are starting to, you know, adjust, but I'm only in this place for like a minute or so. And it's all sort of like half circle booths, mm-hmm. all along the wall and around, and they're kind of that rolled, kind of tufted upholstery of that era. They're black. It's carpet. It's a fairly quiet but lively, you know, crowd. Mm. And then the. Where the booths, you know, sort of curve, it creates a ledge. You know what I mean? You know
right.
what I mean? There's
right.
a ledge behind the booths.
Yeah, yeah.
And all these ledges, there's phones. I'd never seen so many phones in my life. You know,
What were they there
and
for?
And I'm thinking to myself, this is where the deals go down for Hollywood, you know, and these...
So amazing. I've never seen anything like that.
They got to get calls. They got to, you know, connect with people. So,
wow.
It was really interesting. And so he leads me back, and I'm thinking I'm just going to hand this off and, you know,
right.
turn around. And he says, Bruce, you know, you remember Reed? And I said, yeah, hi, Reed. And I met him. And this is so and so who's going to help speed up the permit. And just have a seat.
You know? Oh, I love it. How fun so to I be sit, in that and see that and feel that energy of...
So I sit down and he says, we're going to order a round of drinks. What would you like? I'm thinking this job is different. So I said, I'll have a gin and tonic.
You know? Get right in there.
And
so
the drinks come and they're talking. I'm mostly just listening, of course. I'm, you know,
yeah.
like about 24 and, you know,
yeah,
just
yeah.
soaking it up. But so about a half hour later, he says, mm-hmm. we're gonna order another round and some lunch. And he says, have you eaten? And I said, yeah, I ate just before you called. And then he kind of thinks, he goes, well, maybe you should get back to the office. Conrad's probably wondering where you are.
Oh, I'm just out drinking with the clients. No problem.
But the thing is, I didn't really realize it at the time, but this is their way of like teaching and showing how they work with people and the social life and the profession are mixed. And these lunches
yes.
are, you know, fairly leisurely. They're like a couple hours maybe, you know.
Right. Well, it's the design of their home, and it's that emotional information that you have to really take your time with. I feel that in real estate too. Anytime someone is going through a personal experience, you are the professional that's there with them in that experience. So you can't rush those things. And sometimes you find things out in a meeting that takes an hour or two. You find out, wow, we didn't really want this to begin with, or we prefer this, or, you know, a whole design can change.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is
already set. I mean, this house, it was, this
right.
guy's going to speed it along, but
yeah.
it's just the kind of the way they like to do things. And they often did. They would, usually most of their clients had control of their time, and they usually have a meeting like around 10:30 in the morning.
Yes.
And they would make a lunch appointment for maybe 12. And especially during the early stages, the preliminary design stages. And so they'd have the office meeting, and then they'd go into Pasadena to the Chronicle. That was their favorite place at the time.
That's
an interesting thing, too, is that by setting a lunch appointment, you control the meeting to no more than 90 minutes because they become inefficient.
Right.
And so you have to go.
You have to go. It's time to finish up and leave. It's brilliant. I love that. I love the visual of the phones all over the room. How amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
business and pleasure, hand in hand. There you go.
Right. The cell phone was, you know, a few decades away.
We take that for granted. We take away that, yeah, that appreciation for cell phones. And do you remember MapQuest? We used to just MapQuest everything and print it out, and then we had our directions. Just so amazing. And, you know, Bruce, I have to tell you, you have been like an encyclopedia for me over the years. I will go into a home or meet with a seller of, let's say, a Campbell and Wong or a Don Knorr, and Bruce usually knows the history, the stories, you know, who bid for that project. It's pretty amazing. And I wanted to ask you a couple questions before we close. You know, you have become an expert. I consider you one of the most knowledgeable historians about mid-century modernism. What is it for you, you know, your attraction to this genre, and what does mid-century modernism mean to you?
Well, I think it's kind of like in the Renaissance era, there was the High Renaissance, and I think that's it. Sort of in modern times, that's where it landed.
Yes.
The interesting thing is when I go back to, you know, when I was talking about it, I'm in high school and I'm reading those books and so forth. I was already aware that this era has passed. I mean, that the books weren't that old; they're less than, you know, about 10 years old. But I knew that things had changed just from reading Sunset or, you know, or other design magazines, that it's a more volume kind of architecture, kind of the Sea Ranch. That was what was going on in the 70s. But I still was, you know, really impressed with it. And of course, it kind of went out of fashion there. I mean, the people who lived in it probably still loved it, but it wasn't getting the press, you know. The new ideas were in the books and in the magazines. So,
and as I mentioned before, you were the one who taught me about Buff and Hensman. But out of all of these architects that you know so much about, could you maybe list some of your favorites? I know that you cannot say that you have a favorite architect, but what are some that have deeply inspired you?
Well, here in the Bay Area, I think there was quite a few in that era. Roger Lee, Campbell and Wong, Joseph Escherich. Certainly those are high on my list. I also think a lot of some of Warren Callister's work, as well as some that lean toward the more modern architecture, Don Olson and Don Knorr. Mm-hmm. And in Southern California, they had quite a few, Harwell Harris and Ray Cappy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're definitely going to have you on the show again. And for those of you listening, if you know of another architect that you love and you'd like to know more information, I would venture to say that Bruce probably knows more than any, you know, research that we could all do or any textbook. So feel free to write in and let us know your architect that you would like us to feature. And my last question for you, my dear friend, what is your wish for these homes that are still in existence?
Well, I hope that the owners preserve them and take care of them and try and stay true to the original designs. They're quite enduring when you really get down to it. I mean, compared to other architects, they live well even by today's standards.
Right. Well, thank you so much. And it's always an honor to hear your knowledge. And thank you so much for over the years being that voice of information and that open door to history.
Well, sure. I like to have an outlet for all this stuff.
You need to have a place to put it. What are you going to do with all this information, Bruce? What are you going to do? So we are excited to have you back on the show. And again, everyone, check out more podcasts coming soon. Thanks again, Bruce.
Thank you, Monique.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.